This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe. I'm really happy tonight because I have a great guest. Her name is Leslie Field Cruz. She is the executive director of Black Public Media. And from what I understand, she's also the founder of Black Public Media, which was founded in 1979. She also produces a number of other, I say, Black content programs. Some of them are, well, I could make a long list. I could go on forever, but I'm thinking about Afropop, which is a series that she produces. She also produces the Pitch Black program for Black filmmakers. And I'm going to stop there because I can go on probably for the entire half hour. And I'm going to welcome you to the show, Leslie. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much, Toni. But I'm going to make one quick correction. I am not the founder of Black Public Media. Black Public Media was originally called the National Black Programming Consortium, which was founded in 1979 by Mabel Haddock, who actually hired me many, many years ago and was my mentor. So I want to make sure everybody knows it was Mabel Haddock who was one of the founders of Black Public Media, which was originally called the National Black Programming Consortium.
It's just, you've done so many different things, but tell me, how did you get involved with working really in the field of Black and the content of Black experience? That's the thing that I find particularly impressive.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I was always interested in film and television. Even as a kid, I watched a lot of television and I went to movies all the time. And it really wasn't until I was in college, I went to UC Berkeley and I took a course in Black film. And I was just exposed to this, huge canon of work that I didn't really know existed. And at the time, Spike Lee was creating work. When I was in school, Eyes on the Prize had broadcast on PBS. And so it really opened my eyes to the opportunities in film and television to tell stories about the Black experience. And I really wanted to see stories about myself. I wanted to see stories about my community and my family in all of the, you know, various aspects of who we are as people of the African diaspora. And so I kind of, when I graduated from college, I actually was also, I worked in theater and I was acting. I moved to New York, and yet I still had an interest in film. And a few years later, after I decided that acting wasn't necessarily, or becoming an actor wasn't going to be my calling, I had to just really think about what was it that was a passion of mine that I really felt I wanted to focus on and pursue. And I came back to film. So I ended up going to NYU, securing my master's in cinema studies, because I was like, I don't know if I want to be a filmmaker, but I really do love studying and talking about film and finding ways to get films out to masses of people. And so as luck would have it, one of my classmates worked at the Association for Independent Video and Filmmakers. And, you know, she said, hey, I'm looking for an assistant. Would you mind joining us and becoming, helping out in the membership department? And so I was like, yeah, I'd love to have that job. And so I started working at AIVF, and this was in the late 90s. And I started working there. And at that point in time, the executive director of AIVF, who was Ruby Lerner, had suggested I reach out to a woman named Mabel Haddock, who ran the National Black Programming Consortium. And she said, I just think you should know who she is. She actually, they support a lot of Black filmmakers and they work with PBS. And I went, okay, sure, I'll reach out to her. And so I contacted Mabel, and I was doing a business trip to Ohio because the company used to be, it was based in Ohio at the time. And we met and we chatted, and I learned that they had a film festival called the Prize Pieces Film Festival and that they distributed to public television. And so I invited her to speak to, whenever she was going to be in New York, if she would speak to some filmmakers, I would create a workshop. And she said, sure, I'll do that. So she came out for one of the markets that, you know, at the time there were many markets in New York, film markets. And she came out and she made good on her word. And I set up a panel and she spoke. And so, you know, that sort of established the connection for me and the National Black Programming Consortium. I then went on and actually did some work in youth theater because, again, I was an actor and I love theater. So I continued to do some work there, but I never quite left the film scene and the independent film scene to be specific. So I ended up doing some freelance work for Creative Capital, which is a funder of arts, of the arts, you know, multidisciplinary. And I was working in out of the offices of POV American Documentary and was able to make a connection. Someone reintroduced me to Mabel Haddock, and they were hiring for a grants manager. And that was, at that point in time, that was the person who was going to be working with the filmmakers in terms of funding their projects. And so I applied for the job, and I came in and I said, listen, I know I can do this for you. I really want to make sure that Black stories are available to the public. And I do believe in public television and public media. And so thankfully, they hired me, and 20-some-odd years later, I'm now the executive director of the organization, and we're still funding Black filmmakers and funding Black stories. We've launched our own series called Afropop, The Ultimate Cultural Exchange, and we're starting to make some forays into emerging media, and that's for makers who are creating content on XR or VR platforms. So that's my story.
The way you're telling it, it sounds as if your timing has been very good in terms of being able to get to the point that you are now. And I think that a lot of people don't really, you have to be prepared to get lucky. You were prepared to get lucky with Mabel Haddock.
Yes.
Tell my audience a little bit about Afropop, the series, because I understand that it's very popular. And I think that it's a good way to introduce the idea of Black content that it, with regard to Black experience, which I think from where I sit, it sounds like it's almost become kind of trendy. And I don't even hate to say that, but it seems that it's become kind of trendy as an artist to even express yourself from the Black experience. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. I will definitely say, you know, being Black is not a trend. It is
right.
a day-to-day thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the, when we launched Afropop, The Ultimate Cultural Exchange, it was really in response to the fact that we wanted to make sure that we were able to showcase independent documentaries that covered the breadth of the African diaspora experience. As a person, I'm an African American, my roots go back in this country over 100 years, but I've also had the opportunity to travel, and I have friends from the continent, from the Caribbean, from Brazil and South America. And so I know that, and I used to say, you know, there's no one way to be Black. There's just
it's
so
true.
Many ways,
that
right?
That is very true.
And so we launched the series back in 2008, and with a slate of films that were stories from South Africa. We had a story from Tanzania, a story from the U.S., and I think we even had a story that was about the Black British, story about Black Brits. And so, you know, we did it 1 year. We weren't sure if we were going to continue to do it, but we had a really good response and the public media system wanted the stories. So we said, okay, let's do it again. And so we continued to produce the series, and fast forward, we're now in our 13th year. The series premieres on World Channel, which is one of the public media channels. I'm not quite sure where on the quote-unquote dial it exists, but you can watch it on World Channel. But you can also go to pbs.org and stream it on pbs.org. This year's slate of titles is just fascinating and amazing. They're set, most of them are here in the U.S., but we do have a story, a young woman, it's called Finding Sally. She is Canadian Ethiopia. I think that I'm saying that right. Okay. Anyways, and she goes to Ethiopia to reconnect with her family members. But and through that, she discovers that she had an aunt who died during the Ethiopian Revolution.
Oh, wow.
I guess it was the early 80s. And so she just kind of goes on a quest to find out exactly what happened to her. And she discovers a lot more about her family. So, you know, it's a great way for people to learn about the breadth of the African diaspora, but also some of the intimate experiences that we've had. But, you know, from the perspective, like we've had stories on the series that cover sports. They've covered politics, they've covered health and wellness, immigration, arts and culture. You know, it's just a wonderful platform for us to showcase the breadth of our experience. So.
I love that. I love this. And also you have a program that you work on for Black filmmakers or for films with Black content called Pitch Black. Tell me more about that, because I know a lot of people, I know a lot of people of all colors, every stripe, that talk about the lack of diversity in motion pictures, the lack of diversity in general. But talk about Pitch Black, because I do know a few filmmakers that would love to hear what you have to say about that.
In many cases at Black Public Media, some of our programs are developed because we see that there's a need, and we want to make sure that what we're doing is serving the development of Black stories and serving the development, the career development or the professional development of Black media makers. And so our Pitch Black was designed specifically to be connected to what we call our 360 incubator program. And we invite producers to submit their project ideas. They're accepted into the 360 incubator program, in which they are paired with a mentor. They get one-on-one mentoring. They attend workshops. And they also receive up to $5,000 that they can use towards their film. And then as part of that training, it's also important that they understand how to pitch their program. And so they do attend a pitch workshop. And then we create a forum, which is the Pitch Black Forum. And they are able to pitch their projects. Our goal at the Pitch Black Forum is we're looking to fund the projects, and our funding levels are between $50,000 and $100,000. So it's not cheap. We're funding these projects at a high level. So we have a jury that reviews the projects and listens to the pitches, and they ask questions. But we also know, because we can't fund everything, we invite other industry people to the forum so that they can listen to the pitches, but also make connections with these artists who are out there creating content. So in some cases, they might not necessarily be interested in the project, but they might be interested in working with that filmmaker. And so it's really an opportunity for us to leverage our platform and our connections with the industry, and specifically in public media, to bring them in, expose them to projects that are in development, and filmmakers whose careers, some of them have been mid-career, some of them are emerging filmmakers, you know, but they need support and they need to broaden their network. And so that's what we do at Pitch Black. That's why we created the forum, and we expanded it this year to include VR content. We had a special showcase for our emerging media makers so some of them are working in VR. Some of them are doing XR projects, I believe. Yes, XR projects. And it was great because they were able to talk about the programs that they're developing for these new media platforms.
I love your holistic approach to it as well. You know, the way you've just discussed that, you know, even though someone might not necessarily get the grant, it sounds like you're offering some kind of education to filmmakers. I also appreciate the fact that by having something that really shows like the diversity of just the Black culture, because I have found growing up that a lot of people think that our culture is the same throughout. We do not have the same experience exactly. The experience is very unique, I've found in my life, between my family and let's say another Black family. You know, and I think that making presentations creatively through film, I think I admire you for having like the wherewithal and the foresight to understand how that would really help to, in my view, alleviate a lot of stereotyping, you know, and other prejudices, to see that, yeah, we're a diverse group of people. I have to applaud you for that. I think it's a beautiful thing. So in your experience, you've obviously had a similar experience in that you sort of had, like I say, good timing. You talked about a couple of people. You talked about Spike Lee, for instance. In my opinion, the way I look at it from where I sit, I feel he really opened the world's eyes to who we are as a people, as opposed to doing something that's like, not that I'm putting it down, it wasn't Superfly or Shaft. He really introduced the culture. It sounds like as a woman, you're doing the same thing. You sound like you're, from where I sit again, your approach sounds a little different and it's refreshing.
Well, thank you. And I think that that's the power of the independent filmmaker. They're not going to necessarily do what's going to make a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's great when an independent filmmaker makes a film and there is a great return on it. But it's also they are making a film because they see that there's a story to be told and it hasn't been told. And they're the ones that have to tell it. So in the 80s, when Spike Lee was coming up, there was on the documentary side, I think of Orlando Bagwell and Stanley Nelson, Thomas Allen Harris, you know, some of these filmmakers in the doc world who were creating content and telling stories and stories that people were like, wait, what? I never knew that. And it really is to broaden the understanding of the Black experience because there, you know, I think that just historically, we have been pigeonholed. Our representation has been so limited. And in our everyday lives, we know that there are no limits, right? That it is so vast and expansive in terms of who we are. And I think that it is, and I guess I knew that as a young person, and I just wanted to find a way to amplify these stories. And so my being at Black Public Media and, you know, my circuitous road to get to the organization is really because that's what I understood as what's most important. My mission is to make sure that these stories are out there because there's just no one way to be who we are.
Exactly. I'm glad you said that. And it sounds to me like you've known it all along, the way you're talking, you always knew. It's interesting. We are diverse. We are a diverse group of people. We're a diverse culture. Collectively, and we're diverse even in our little individual subsections of ourselves, I've found, and it's a beautiful, good thing. So how do you feel your affiliation with PBS is? Because it almost sounds like BPM is like the Black PBS.
that's funny that you say that because when we changed our name, someone said, are you sure there might not be some confusion? And I'm like, no, we're definitely not the Black PBS, but we are partners with PBS. Black Public Media is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They're one of our core funders. We do receive support from other private foundations and corporate entities, which is great because it gives us a little bit of flexibility. But our mission is to make sure that we have content that, or at least that our content is accessible to the American public. And that's why our relationship with PBS is so important, because the content that we're funding, the content that we end up distributing, we need to make sure that the public has access to it because part of it is developed with public dollars. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, they're a private corporation run by the American or funded by the American people. So some of our tax dollars are going into the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which supports the PBS system and all the stations that are there. They, you know, they don't have all of their funding does not come from just CPB. It's a portion. Everybody has to do the regular fundraising and everything else. But it is so important that we have our PBS, our public television, or I should say our public media system, because there are still people across the country who cannot afford a subscription to Netflix or who cannot afford, they can't afford cable, and yet they need access to quality information. And so Black Public Media, we work with PBS. They are our partners, a key partner. And, you know, the public part is really our commitment to making sure that this content is available for the public.
It sounds like that is the foundation of PBS was actually founded on that premise that you just, you know, explained. But I've also found over the years, and I imagine it's the same with BPM, and I can't imagine it's not the same with PBM, is that when there are people out here, okay, that are always looking for something different than what is on the normal cable stations or even the regular channels like 2, 4, 5, 7, whatever. And if you really want to see something different and be entertained and educated at the same time, I've always found, and I've learned, and we've kind of taught this in school when I was growing up, you look to PBS for that. I'd like to see the same thing happen for BPM. Because when you talk about content, it's, and especially Black content, it's something that it sort of like stirs me inside. I feel like, yeah, things are getting better. You know, what is the general sort of view? Like, what kind of feedback do you get about BPM, Black Public Media, from where you sit?
You know, I mean, most of the feedback, because it's interesting, because I receive this question, like, who's your core constituency? And because we work primarily or directly, we have more direct content with the media makers. And then once the project is completed, it's, you know, we work within the public media system. So series like POV or Independent Lens, American Experience, American Masters, we work with those series to distribute the films. Of course, we have our own with the Afropop series as well, but we work with all of those other national series to distribute the content. And so sometimes I get a little frustrated because people don't know Black Public Media. They don't know what we're doing. They don't know why it's important to support us as well as support their public media station. There was a film that was broadcast, I think it was Mr. Soul. Mr. Soul was broadcast this year. And, you know, we were first public funders of that project. And the filmmaker, Melissa Hayslip, who's an amazing filmmaker, you know, it took her a number of years to complete that project. And it's a hustle for them because our funding, it's not like we do make substantial grants, but it's not all of the money for them to complete their film. So they use the funding and leverage it so that they can attract more dollars. And then, of course, it goes on, once it's complete, it's distributed on public media. But sometimes people forget that Black Public Media is there for the filmmakers. The filmmakers don't forget. They're usually like, oh no, you need support. You need to go to Black Public Media, you know, which is great. But there is a connection that often gets lost once the film reaches the audience. And one of the challenges that the system, that the PBS system has right now, is that they need to do a much better job connecting to younger audiences and more diverse audiences.
Yeah,
younger. You know, and that audience isn't watching television in the same way that, at least I know that I did when I grew up. I mean, it was appointment viewing when we were kids, right? When Eyes on the Prize came on, it was like, oh my gosh, everybody sit down. We're going to watch Eyes on the Prize. Whereas now a program will come on and I'll tell my kids and they'll say, okay, great. And they'll watch it on their time when they're ready.
Right. It's because they can.
Because they can. Right. Because they can. Because they can.
That wasn't always the case.
That wasn't always the case. And so public media has to figure out, how do we do a better job making sure that we're connecting consistently with the younger and more diverse audiences, finding ways to go to where they are, making sure that they are aware of the program and where they can access it, instead of trying to get people to watch it tonight at 7 o'clock or at 8 o'clock, because they're just not going to. They just need to know that it's out there and that it's on public media, you know, that they can go to pbs.org or they can come to Black Public Media and we will have a link that will take them to PBS, so the pbs.org, so they can watch it and stream it.
So does BPM have a reach similar to PBS? Because, you know, if you go to another city in another state on the other side of the country or in the middle of the country, you can find PBS. Has BPM gotten to the point where you can actually do the same?
I mean, we're online. We have a website, so you can find us anywhere around the country. You can go to blackpublicmedia.org and you can find us. But because we're not a station or a channel in
right,
that way,
right,
we're not, you know, I don't know. People have to know who we are in order to find us. Mm-hmm. That's why our visibility, it's important for people to know who we are so that they can watch us. We have our own YouTube channel.
Oh,
most of the content that's there, we have, it goes back years at this point, but we run our trailers for the programs that we support. We did a campaign, a social media campaign last fall. It was called Vote Be Heard, and it was to encourage people to get out and vote and to understand what they needed to do in order to register or if they wanted to volunteer at the polls. And so it was, we have the short pieces on our YouTube channel. But it was a social media campaign, which was specifically designed so we could reach younger and more diverse audiences. So if you go and you watch, it's like one of these little 1 minute clips with short conversations between influencers. Actually, Gabby Sidibe was one of the folks who was featured.
She's very famous.
Yeah, she's great. And her, she was talking with an Ohio politician and they were talking about reparations. And I thought it was just real clip, real short clips. So those are some of the ways that we're trying to connect directly with the audience. But we really are, our organization is really designed to work in partnership with public media and to attract or bring audiences, diverse audiences to public media. Or at least at this point, I'm like, okay, public media, you're going to have to go out to those diverse audiences because they're not going to come to you.
That's true. But I think also about the fundraising drives that public media does. There's certain times of the year where they do a lot of major fundraising. How has the pandemic affected you financially?
What's interesting for Black public media, we're small and we're nimble. So we had already started working remotely. We have an office in Harlem. Mm-hmm. That's where our main office is, but it's in a workshare space. And so, you know, I live here in Northern Westchester and I go into the office once or twice a week. And that was before the pandemic. So, and I had my key directors, the director of operations and our support staff that were at the office on a regular basis. Once the pandemic hit, I said, okay, well then everybody, we're all going to work remotely. And, you know, we increased our subscription to Zoom so that everybody could have access without getting cut off after 45 minutes,
right.
You know, but in terms of the fundraising, I think that the pandemic on top of the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, it caused, you know, a lot of people to stop and start to look at how they're supporting Black-led nonprofits, Black-led businesses. And so we've been able to continue to work throughout this pandemic. We've actually had people who contacted us because they realize that they want to support the development of Black stories and they want to work through an organization like ours. I think what has been the biggest challenge, it's not necessarily for us, but it's for our filmmakers, because many of them had to stop production. Either they stopped productions on their own projects, or if they were working on other projects, they lost work, they were furloughed, or they were told, hey, we don't know when we're going to start. So, you know, your freelance gig is not going to happen right now. And in response to that, we ended up launching I talked to one of our funders and I said, listen, can I redirect some of this money so we can have an emergency relief fund for our makers? Because some of them are really hurting. And they said, absolutely, go ahead and do it. And then I had another funder who found out what we were doing. This was the Perspective Fund. And so they made a commitment and they gave us some dollars. And so, you know, it wasn't a lot of money that we gave out, but it was $30,000 that we gave last year to independent media makers because they were the ones who were hurting much more so than us. And at the end of the day, for us, we're like, okay, that means that projects that we funded, they had to postpone or they had to stop production, which means that we're probably not going to see these films for another year, right? We're expecting them to be delivered in the fall of 2020 or the spring of 2021. And now their production schedule has been pushed up. So we might not be seeing some of these films until 2022, 2023.
It's a while away.
That's definitely one of the impact of the pandemic. But in terms of our day-to-day, we're able to keep moving forward. you know, and with the support, even with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we applied for the NEA. We applied for funding support there, and we were awarded. So I think that we'll be okay. And I just want to make sure that that our makers will be all right.
How can one best donate to BPM if someone's out here is listening and people are listening? How can one best donate to BPM to just help this cause, even if it's to something specific like Pitch Black, or, you know, how would you say is, what would you say is the best way to donate to BPM?
Well, go to our website, which is www.blackpublicmedia.org. And when you get to the website, you will see a button that says donate. You click on that button and you'll have ways to donate to Black Public Media. We have a shop. You can also buy some merch, and that's another way to support us.
You're reading my mind, Leslie. I was just about to say that.
All right. Yeah. You can go there. You can do one of the two, donate or shop.
If I carry the tote bag around, how many people will I see that'll look at that? You know, but mm-hmm. I think it's a very worthy cause to donate to. I've always found, and you probably agree, that when the arts get involved in something, when the arts involve themselves in something, or when a business is having a problem, they always, you know, go to the arts to see if they can do something to make it better creatively. I think it's wonderful that you're helping Black filmmakers get a voice out there. I mean, what do you think the balance is in everything that BPM is doing? You know, what do you think the biggest thing is? Because I've talked about a few things, and there's more. You know, like I said, if I had given you the full throttle introduction based on everything that you've done, there'd be no time to talk about it. I particularly like the fact you're investing in the idea of content by helping Black filmmakers or films with Black content. I don't know anyone else who's doing it. I don't know anyone else who's doing it the way you're doing it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, we are, I will thankfully say that we're not the only organization out there, but we are the only organization that is micro-focused on Black stories, that is, and Black stories that are specifically designed to reach the public, the American public, right? And that the content is free and available to the public. So, you know, there are other organizations out there, but they work, you know, and it's great because they're supporting more commercial filmmakers that want to make movies in Hollywood and stuff. And that's great because not everybody wants to make a documentary. Not everybody wants to make a short that's extremely thought-provoking and intense, right? Not everybody wants to make a biography on, you know, on a James Baldwin or something like that. But Black Public Media, that's our niche, and that's what we support. And again, I'll also add, in terms of the emerging media platforms, that's an area that at this point we are the only ones. We are the only Black organization that's actually funding the content, the development of the content. There's a lot of different groups that are working together to try to bring resources to makers or emerging media makers, but we gave out two $60,000 grants. In fact, we've been working in emerging media for the past 3 years. We started the initiative in 2018. I brought on my emerging media director, Lisa Osborne, and she has just carved an incredible niche for us in this area, in such that at the Tribeca Festival this year, we had three projects that we funded that were at the Tribeca Festival.
That's outstanding.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's so amazing. And then another one of the projects that went through our 360 incubator, Greenwood Avenue, is one of the first, I think it's at this point, it's the only VR project that is set during the Tulsa massacre. That's the strength of what we do, because we're focused on Black stories. We're able to find the stories that people haven't told.
Yeah, that's very important, because there are a lot of stories that haven't been told, and there are a lot of stories that are told that aren't true. And so
yeah, exactly.
We need you, BPM, we do. And in closing, I want to ask this question. It's a little provocative, but I'm going to take a chance. Do you think that things are getting better
in the world or in media or?
Well, with regard to how people of color are being presented in the media. And it's a provocative question.
No. And it's a provocative, but it's an important question because I think the answer, it's a yes and no answer, right? Mm-hmm. If I look back on, my childhood, the representations of Black people in film and television, we get so excited about, the film, a film that came out. I remember when The Wiz came out. I was so excited about The Wiz, and I didn't see the play. I just wanted to see the movie. Mm-hmm. I saw the movie, and I hated the movie because I was like, why is Diana Ross playing a kid?
I know. Like, she's a little bit too mature
old
for that.
Exactly. But, it was like the one thing. I was like, okay, well, at least we have that, right? Mm-hmm. And yet now, today, when you look at the fact that my kids can go on and they can watch Lovecraft Country. They can watch The Watchmen. They can tune in and watch Mr. Soul. They can watch, of course, every single time I do this, none of the titles come to me readily, but there's so much more content out there for them to watch that are different types of stories about the Black experience. So I think that we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. I just recently, my post, what we call our weekly dispatch, what I wrote about was they were doing a Black version of First Wives Club, or they're doing a Black version of The Wonder Years. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I get it. These have built-in audiences, but you know what? So did that film Roll Bounce, which was about these middle schoolers that went to a roller skating rink, and the filmmaker and the writer, the director was Black because it was Malcolm D. Lee, and the writer is Norman B. Vance Jr. So, these are Black artists. Why not make a series based off of that film?
Yeah.
And so then the money goes to support these artists, these makers who are telling stories that are originally from the Black experience, not shoehorned into a white gaze.
Yes.
Right. And so I think that's where I feel like we're getting on a little shaky ground in this, like, we want to make sure that we provide opportunities for Black makers to tell stories. And I'm like, okay, but, and that's not to say makers and actors, they need to work. Documentary filmmakers, they need to work. So I'm not saying don't do it, but let us not get caught in a trap of just rehashing, white stories with Black faces. We have such a rich and vast experience that you can tell so many stories.
Yeah, it runs very deep.
There's really no need to redo a Wonder Years. There really isn't. There's no need to redo a First Wives Club. There isn't. You have Insecure. Insecure was great. And I think that it's like, why do First Wives Club? Just do a whole different, make another film. You can tap into that audience, but you don't have, and I think about it again on from a monetary perspective, it's like that money's going to go back to the originators of the film.
That's very true. And some people look at it only that way, because sometimes that's the only way it really is, mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that what you're saying is really relevant. And I think that's interesting that times are changing, seems like rapidly all the time. And every time I wake up, there's something different to be concerned about, especially with regard to race and how you're presented. But I always tell people I've been Black my whole life. You really, mm-hmm. and I really know what I'm talking about. But I want to say thank you, Leslie, and I'd love to have you on again because there were so many other things I wanted to talk to you about, and it's just hard to get it all in, especially when I'm getting the wrap up signal from Jim. But I really, I know that that people are going to love hearing from you. I can hardly wait to share it.
Well, thank you.
And I thank you for doing what you do. And I would love to talk to you more, maybe at some point when time permits, on both sides here. We must readdress this because I know by the time I hang up the phone here, something else will change with regard to...
It's like we have to be, cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic.
That's who we are. That we are cautiously optimistic. I think we have to have optimism. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten as far as we have. But we have to be very cautious because we know how quickly the backlash can be.
That's true. And things are transforming. And that in itself is dangerous in a strange kind of way. But I'm a perpetual optimist. So I'm going to assume that you're going to give me another interview, Leslie, in the future.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure, Tony. Thank you.
It'll be fresh. It'll be different because that's the way we are. And I thank you again for coming on the show. Thank you very much for coming to the cafe. And I'll thank the audience for coming to the cafe once again, the Energy Stoners Cafe. And I'll see you next time. And as I always promise, I'll have the most interesting person I can find this week on the planet. And I appreciate everybody for listening. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.